We're going to hear today number 718 of the 2024 terms, County Commissioners of Worcester County versus Ayers Creek Investments. Council, come on up. Make yourselves comfortable and get ready. And Mr. Leslie, wherever, whenever you are, sir.
Good morning, Roscoe Leslie for the County Commissioners of Worcester County. Ayers Creek, the appellee in this case, wants to build up here in a subdivision where you're not allowed to build up here. Piers weren't allowed in this subdivision since it was developed 20 years ago. So the County Commissioners are just maintaining the current policy. This isn't a new or novel interpretation of anything that we've pulled out of the bag. We're just following land record documents that have been on record for 20 years. Winding Creek is a subdivision in Worcester County. It's on the way to Assateague. It's either open to the state park or the federal park. You've passed it. Relatively small, 60 or 70 homes on half-acre lots. But in the back, there's a waterfront area that is on a creek called Ayers Creek, and there are five large estate lots on that body of water. These are all owned by Ayers Creek Investment, or the individual that owns them. It's the same entity that owns all five. And there's one house on this shoreline that he owns. And again, when this subdivision was developed, it was purposely set up so that these creek front lots did not have water rights, did not have riparian rights, that you could not build up here. There's some key documents, namely there was a deed to the county from the developer that deeded all the marshy outlots to, or the marshy areas bordering the five lots, deeded this to the county.
So when the county did that, did the county own the property that it was deeding? Or did the developer own the property that it was deeding to the county?
Yes. Some of it is state wetlands, some of it is private wetlands. It was never delineated exactly which area was state wetlands and which area was private wetlands, but it was on the plat. The developer had that property platted in the land records for the plat prior to that.
Okay. So isn't that a problem, the fact that it wasn't delineated?
If you're right, it was done this way at the request of the developer so that they did not have to do the delineation of the difference between the state and the federal, and the, excuse me, the private wetlands. It was saved them money of not having to do the delineation, plus it lowered their open space requirements so that they didn't have to have this area didn't count as part of the subdivision, so they didn't have to have as much other green space. So it was done at their request for their advantage back when it was developed. And the state was well aware of this. The state wetlands coordinator has a letter in the file that indicated that they understood that this is what was happening and that a delineation wasn't going to be required. This is the wetlands administrator who works in the Board of Public Works, who's responsible for taking care of the state's property.
So below you said in argument for the circuit court that in an ideal world there should have been a deed from the state. How do we get around that?
Sure. That the second key document is the conservation easement. So this was document that, again, created a conservation easement right next to the platted original deed. So you have the deed in the marsh and the conservation easement area are one, the border on them is lined up exactly. So the conservation easement has a 100-foot buffer going from the shoreline backwards, and then the deed was supposed to contain the marsh. So you have a uninterrupted area where it's either the deed to the county or protected by the conservation easement. So you have the two documents that go against each other. So even if the deed fails, there's the conservation easement that says there's to be no structures in the buffer, no means of access. This was deeded to the Lower Shore Land Trust, with the county had the rights as a third-party beneficiary to enforce all of the rights in the deed of easement. which subsequently we have now become, the Lower Shore Land Trust has transferred the easement to the county anyway. That has happened since these documents, or since this appeal has been filed. So we have the deed, and now we have the deed of easement. So these two documents together create what I would say the armor around the coastline.
So with regard to your third-party beneficiary theory, vis-a-vis the buffer, walk me through how the circuit court was wrong when it construed that easement.
Well, they didn't address, again, the Maryland case law that we cited that acknowledges that there are third-party beneficiaries to deed of conservation easements. The circuit court judge did not address that law at all.
Isn't, when it talked about the language of the easements and who had the right to enforce which, who had enforcement rights, I mean, didn't it implicitly reject your third-party beneficiary theory?
Sure, but they didn't address it specifically. That's just my point. But again, the easement has very broad enforcement language, and the circuit court seemed to reason that you couldn't be the ownership, the habenum clause, the have clause, prohibited the county from having the rights to enforce the document. But again, that is just the ownership interest. You can not have an ownership interest, but have enforcement rights. That's what a third-party beneficiary is. They're a third party that has that benefit. They're not the owner. The owner can transfer the property, or can transfer the easement interest, or terminate the easement interest. It's distinct from having enforcement rights. Is not mandatory that you have ownership rights.
I thought Judge Debilius was distinguishing, though, some rights versus others under the conservation easement. And I thought what he was saying was that, I mean, he gets around to at the end, while arguably the trust could appear in its force its rights under the buffer easement, it has not chosen to do so. And instead, you know, in the paragraph before that, says it would be an unnatural stretch and would render the distinctions made in the to have and to hold clause meaningless if the county could enforce the buffer restrictions granted only to the trust. So he seemed to be seeing a distinction between what the county could enforce and the trust could enforce, even under the life of that document. So help me first of all with that, and second of all with this new fact out of nowhere that the county has now taken the trust's...
It's been assigned to us. Lower Shore Land Trust It was in a footnote in my brief.
Okay. All right. I missed that somehow, but anyway...
But that didn't happen. That happened after Judge Debilius issued his decision.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Are you claiming that solves it?
No,
I mean, because Judge Debilius seemed to think there was a difference between what the county could enforce and the trust could enforce.
Sure.
And then if you go through and have the county transfer all of its interest in the easement... I'm sorry, the trust transfer all of its rights in the easement to the county, then that should wash that distinction away, but that's not what you're arguing. So now I'm confused.
Well, I just bring that up as a side. If we were to not be successful in this case and Ayers Creek is successful, they will come apply to the county and we're going to turn them down again because we now are the owners of the conservation easement.
Now I'm even more confused. If there were elements of the easement that the trust could enforce and the county couldn't, and vice versa, then you have to deal with that. And I'd like you to respond to
sure.
Judge Debilius's
sure.
holding in that regard.
Sure. Again, I think that easement is written very broadly that we have the rights to enforce all of the rights under the easement.
Your response is he's just wrong about that.
Yes.
Okay.
If he makes the point that is saying that, it means that they can enforce their rights independently of each other. That's what the whole point of the all the rights language is that the Lower Shore Land Trust can enforce their rights and the county can enforce their rights. But that's implicit in any deed or easement that you have the rights to enforce your property rights in it. It doesn't need to be specifically spelled out. The way it is spelled out specifically here means that it's above and beyond what is the default. The default is that you only can enforce your rights. The contract language says we can enforce all of the rights. That means all of the rights, our rights and the Lower Shore Land Trust rights.
But then in the meantime, the trust has transferred all of its rights under the easement to the county anyway. So how does that affect our analysis here, in your view?
I don't think it affects the analysis.
Well, let's say we think Judge DeBeely's got it right. Does the transfer then, is the transfer meant to solve the problem he identified there?
I think it does solve that problem. The Lower Shore Land Trust just was, I think, frankly tired of being in the middle of this, and they would just wanted to get out of it.
Okay.
So you would concede, I think, that, do you agree that the conservation easement is not in the chain of title to Lot 14?
No. I don't. Has that been asserted that it's not in the chain of title? I don't think that's an issue, a notice issue, that Harris Creek didn't have.
I thought that there was an affidavit below that said that the conservation easement was not in the chain of title to Lot 14.
I'm blanking on that point. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I may have that wrong, but I would take it then your view is that the conservation easement as to the buffer is enough to extinguish the riparian rights that exist or would have existed for Lot 14.
Sure. It says all no unnatural activities, no means of access, no structures. To me, if you can build a dock in a conservation easement, it's not a very effective conservation easement.
You could write a conservation easement that would allow that.
Sure. But the purpose of this, if you look at the context of the TRC, the Planning Commission and the other planning meetings, everybody expected there not to be riparian rights. The covenants were written so that it says that there's no structures in the buffer area. The minutes from those planning meetings indicate that there was to be no riparian rights. If you, again, look at the context of the whole transaction, we have five different layers of documents showing that this area was never intended to have riparian rights. And again, in my briefing, I mentioned that we have similar situations all over the county. Usually it's the marshy areas are owned by the Homeowners Association. But the whole point is that there are no riparian rights, or there's community piers where everybody bundles theirs together. If we're allowing people to bust through these conservation easements in these marshy areas, there's going to be much more disturbance in the waterfront around Worcester County. So we think this has potential application in many other situations nearby.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Mudd, you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. Christopher Mudd on behalf of Harris Creek Investments. May it please the court. This dispute began when Worcester County refused to process a shoreline construction permit to construct a 3-foot-wide, 12-foot-long platform in open, navigable waters in the state of Maryland along Lot 14 of Winding Creek Estates, which is owned by my client, Harris Creek Investments, or ACI. ACI appealed to the County Board of Zoning Appeals. The county instructed the board not to have a hearing. The county's rationale for not processing the permit application and for not holding a hearing was that Lot 14 does not have riparian rights. ACI appealed to the circuit court, seeking to have that court require the board to hold a hearing on the permit. The court, in November of 23, ordered that the board has to hold a hearing on the permit, and the court ordered that primary jurisdiction over the question as to riparian rights lies with the court and not the board. ACI also filed a declaratory judgment action seeking the circuit court's determination of riparian rights as to Lot 14, and that's what brings us here today. That's ultimately what's before this court. The question is, does Lot 14 have riparian rights under Maryland common law? And the question ultimately boils down to three inquiries, which are formulated by the longstanding cases of Gunby, Conrad Dommel, and Williams. And those three inquiries are, does the undisputed evidence demonstrate that Lot 14 bears the physical requirements for establishment of riparian rights? Has there been an express, definite, and clear reservation of those rights onto some third party other than ACI? Or has there been an express, definite, and clear severance or conveyance of those rights onto some third party other than ACI? I'm going to walk the court this morning through the answers to these three questions, and I will also explain why the court should not get distracted by a number of the arguments made by appellants, which relate to issues that are simply not justiciable in this case. At the outset, I want to explain some of the guiding principles of riparian rights. First, the state of Maryland owns navigable waters to the mean high tide water line throughout the state. Navigable waters means waters where there is an ebb and flow of the tide. That's from the Larmar case. So if land is below the mean high tide water line, it belongs to the state. And if it's above the mean high tide water line, it's in private ownership. The second principle, privately owned land that becomes inundated below the mean high tide water line reverts to state ownership by operation of law. This is also from Larmar. If a parcel is owned and the sea level rises through natural ebb and flow of the tide, i.e. not a violent storm, for example, the state comes to own that land under the navigable waters. This is known as the rule of submergence, which is in the Department of Natural Resources versus Mayor and Council of Ocean City case, and also in the Windsor Resort case. The third principle of riparian rights is that a parcel that binds on the mean high tide water line has riparian rights under Maryland common law. This bestows a broad set of rights unto an owner, not just the right to construct a pier or a single individual right, but a whole set of rights that are generally categorized to access and use of the water subject to regulation. The Conrad Dommel case does a good job of laying out these bundle of rights. It includes at least the following rights: access to water, to build a pier into the water, to use water without transforming it, to consume the water, to accretions, to prevent erosion of your property, and to own the subsoil of non-navigable streams and other private waters. The fourth riparian rights principle is that riparian rights presumptively pass on from owner to owner. In the Gunby case, the court said, a conveyance of land bordering on navigable water presumptively carries with it the right grantor's riparian rights, which takes us to the fifth and final principle, and that is that riparian rights may only be severed by an express, definite, and clear reservation of those rights unto a grantor of property or an express, definite, and clear severance or conveyance of those rights unto a third party. Again, this is from Conrad Dommel and Gunby. In Conrad Dommel, the court said, absent an express reservation, it is presumed as a matter of law that the riparian rights are conveyed in a deed. From Gunby, the court said, riparian rights may be separated from the ownership of the land to which they are appurtenant, either by grant of such rights to another in a deed or by reservation of rights to the grantor as part of the conveyance of this land. And the severance or reservation must be express, definite, and clear. And I keep repeating that, but that's the most important piece of this entire case, frankly, and that's from the Gunby case. The importance of all of this, of these cases, is that the importance of having it be so expressed, definite, and clear is to definitively state the status of riparian rights in the chain of title, so that purchasers and owners of property are clearly and keenly aware of what rights they do and what they do not have, what rights they are bargaining for.
So let me get to that point for a second. If the conservation easement for the buffer was in the chain of title, why isn't that good enough to put your client on notice, to have put your client on notice that they couldn't build a pier?
I think there's a couple things about that, Your Honor. First of all, there is Mr. Wilkins' affidavit demonstrates that the pier is actually to be constructed not within the buffer at all. It's within the navigable waters of the state. It's within Ayers Creek. So the notion of the buffer prohibiting a pier has no application to the pier being located outside of the buffer.
Hold on for a second. Are you saying that the two pilings that are on the land as the end of the pier are not in the buffer?
The pier in its entirety are, according to the affidavits and the undisputed evidence in this case, are to be entirely within Ayers Creek. And okay. Not within the buffer.
Okay.
Another reason, Your Honor, is that I think that if you read...
So I just want to make sure I understand sure. that for a second. So you're saying that even if the county had the right to... And I'm going to put words in your mouth for a moment. Even if the county had the right to enforce the conservation easement, that given the location of the pier itself, it would not be, or building it would not be a violation of that conservation easement.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it also brings up a good point, Your Honor, and it kind of goes back to the table I was trying to set in my opening. We're not here, and this is one of the things that we're asking the court not to do. We're not here to enforce the conservation easement. We're here to determine whether or not riparian rights exist. And so to further answer your initial question, I think it's pretty clear under the Gunby case that whatever language is in this conservation easement was not expressed, definite, and clear.
Well, hold it. If this pier is entirely in Ayers Creek, why does any of this matter? You don't have, your clients don't have any rights to state-owned waterway, right?
No, we absolutely do. The riparian rights that come
you
along.
You have common law riparian rights, whatever those are.
Correct.
You don't have, but those riparian rights end at the mean water line.
Correct.
So this pier is going to be floating out in the water. And not connected to your client's property.
There's the mean high tide water line is where riparian rights begin.
I get that, but I'm asking a simpler
sure,
question.
No.
This pier is going to be out in the state-owned waters and not actually touch your client's property.
No, it actually will be on our client's property. So the mean high tide water line is an area where...
So it's not completely in Ayers Creek.
It is completely within the mean high tide water line of Ayers Creek.
Then why is it touching your client's property if as you said, going back to the beginning of time, that the state owns everything from the mean high water line out?
Right, because there's other portions of water that are above the mean high tide water line that are still submerged, but not the mean high tide water line, that would not be lands of the state, but would be part of Lot 14.
But the pier's not going to touch any of those.
Well, even if the pier is in that part,
it is or it isn't.
Because you answered
Judge Albright's question by saying none of this matters because the pier's not going to touch anything other than area below the mean high water line that's owned by the state, so nothing, the county's got nothing to say about any of this. But now you keep hedging on me. Because what I'm just trying to make a mental picture of a pier that's only in the state waters.
Sure.
And every time I try to get you and I to agree on that picture, you keep saying, well, actually, it will go farther than that. So which is it? Does the pier go inland from the mean high water line?
No.
Yes or no? Then why are we here? You don't need a permit? If that's true, you shouldn't need a permit from the county. You shouldn't need anything from anybody. Just build your pier.
Well, we do need permission from MDE and
okay,
from
well, that's not in this case.
Correct.
So go get your state permit. Go get whatever else you need from somebody other than the county or the land trust. Why are we here?
I guess it's because the consultants said that we need to get this permit, so we made application for the permit, which must be part of the process in Worcester
County.
Well,
the whole factual premise of the relief you sought in the circuit court sounds like it's wrong.
I'm not sure I follow.
I just don't understand what permissions you need from the county or from the land trust or from anybody.
Right.
That what rights do you need to have declared vis-a-vis the county and the land trust if this pier really is, as a factual matter, not going to touch anything other than state water? I'm at that level of density here.
Okay. Well, I think there is a local permit that is required. And we were never even given the chance to process that permit.
What permit do you need if it's all on state? If it's all in Ayers Creek, you opened up by saying this is not going to go on anything other than state-owned navigable waters. So what do you, I mean, what do you need from the county?
We need
you filed a declaratory judgment action asking the circuit court to declare rights that you succeeded in getting, but I don't understand why you're here.
Because we still have to process this permit. Whose
permit?
A Worcester County shoreline construction application.
Well, why is it required if it's not touching any county property?
If it's not touching county property,
it's not touching anything other than the state's navigable waters, right?
Yeah.
So what do you need from the county?
We need our consultants informed that we need this permit.
Are the consultants right about that?
It's the undisputed evidence. The
law is the law. A consultant saying you need some permit that you don't need as a matter of law doesn't make it true. Is it true or not?
Your Honor, as far as I know, we need the permit that we've applied for, and we've asked the court to determine whether or not riparian rights exist.
All right. I'll ask Mr. Leslie then a rebuttal because I don't understand.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Can I go back to a question? Was the location of the pier, whether it was one end in the buffer or not, was the materiality and the disputed or undisputed nature of that fact something that Judge DeBelius found?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think Judge DeBelius was focused on whether or not we had riparian rights. And as you heard from Mr. Leslie this morning, once we get through this issue and we firmly believe that riparian rights do exist as to 14, we will proceed through whatever procedures necessary. It sounds like the county is going to try and stop that, so we may be back on other issues. But he was focused on, I believe he was focused on whether or not riparian rights exist as to Lot 14.
And not on the precise location of this?
Where the precise location of the mean high tide water line was, I mean, that was definitely, wasn't even a dispute. Mr. Wilkins made an affidavit. I guess there was a dispute. The county had an expert, and the expert came in and said he didn't do it right. The county, actually a county witness, it was not an expert. The county person was not an engineer, was not a surveyor. So we had a responsive affidavit from Mr. Wilkins again, who gave the explanation that he performed his analysis and consistent with MDE requirements and NOAA requirements. And in doing that, I think it's undisputed that he determined the appropriate location of the mean high tide water line. He also determined that he was the third surveyor who had found the mean high tide water line in this location. And he also noted that while the, to Your Honor's point in Mr. Leslie's presentation, there may not have been a delineation of where the mean high tide water line and where the wetlands were at the time of platting, but our expert did note that his location of where the mean high tide water line vis-a-vis Lot 14 was consistent with the state title wetlands note that was on a plat, which begs the question of whether or not the 111 acres, or at least the portion that binds on Lot 14, whether or not that was ever properly conveyed to the state of Maryland to begin with.
So let me go back to the mean high tide water line. Mr. Wilkins says there's 39 feet of, I'll say, waterfront property that is on Lot 14 that binds on the water. So was there a finding by the judge that, I want to make sure I understand, that the dock is not necessary, did the judge say the dock is going to be within 39 feet? Because I haven't seen that. That the pier is going to be within the 39 feet.
I don't know if that finding was made, Your Honor. I think that the reason that the 39 feet was limited to that in that area was because that's where the dock was, they're proposing to put it. So we were validating for future part of processing where the riparian rights existed. He says he didn't survey the entire waterfront beyond Lot 14. And frankly, I'm not sure he evaluated the entirety of Lot 14. He did the frontage where the dock was going to be or the pier was going to be installed.
Okay. So what we're here about is potentially whether there are riparian rights somewhere.
Correct. Well, as to the 39 feet.
The 39 feet.
Right. So we're and importantly, where whether or not those rights have ever been expressly, definitively, and clearly severed. And we assert that there's nowhere in the record that that has happened. And again, I think the Gunby case is instructive for the court. In that case, there actually wasn't.
So let me go back for a second. Walk me through again, why isn't the conservation easement adequate to extinguish those rights?
I think if you look through the conservation easement, there is no express, definitive, and clear reference at all to riparian rights. It talks about how it is generally for environmental purposes and preservation of open space. And in the Gunby case, there actually was a note on a record plat in that case. And that note said that riparian rights were being reserved unto the developer in that case.
What part about all activities not naturally occurring are prohibited on the property and buffer is unclear?
Pardon me?
The very first of the prohibited and restrictive activities under the easement
says,
A, all activities not naturally occurring are prohibited on the property and buffer.
Right.
So if this conservation easement applies to this 39 feet, what part is unclear about not building a pier on that?
Well, the 39 feet would be the location where this easement would no longer be applicable.
You're hopping over the premise of my question.
Okay.
Judge Albright, I thought, was asking. Let me ask it this way. If it were true that the easement applied to the 39 feet, mm-hmm. you were just trying to argue that it didn't cover this pier. And I'm struggling to understand what part of all activities not naturally occurring are prohibited is unclear.
Piers don't
bubble up out of the
sure.
out of the water on their own.
Well, I think you're making the assumption that
asking a question.
Sure.
Naturally occurring. Don't fight me. It says all activities not naturally occurring are prohibited.
Right.
What is unclear about that? If this applies, how does that prohibition allow you to build a pier that is not going to be naturally occurring?
How does that prohibition allow me? I'm not being asked to make the assumption that that definitely applies. In other words,
let me start again.
If this applies, then a pier cannot be built. I guess that's what you're saying. Sure.
Because I thought you were saying the opposite. I thought you were saying applies, a pier still can be built.
No, our position is that this definitely does not apply where the pier is proposed to be built. That's our position.
Okay. I thought you were answering Judge Albright by saying this wasn't clear enough to prohibit the pier.
Well, so what I was saying is it's not clear enough to prohibit riparian rights.
That's not what she was asking you.
Okay. My apologies. I thought that was the question.
All right. I'm sorry, Judge Albright. I didn't mean to hijack your question.
No. The conservation easement goes to Land's End. And because the water is navigable after Land's End at the Mean High waterline, there is a point where the pier is going to be built that is within the waters of the state.
Correct.
So my question is simply explain how it looks. I mean, I don't know how to build piers. But is any part of the pier going to be attached to the dry land?
No.
Okay. There's no part of it that's going to be within the part that is covered by the conservation easement.
Correct. That's what the affidavit found.
Okay, so it's going to be, use maybe an inexact word, floating, so to speak.
So this is where I was trying to distinguish between the mean high tidewater line and not. So there may be water and wet areas that are above the mean high tide water line, but still wet. And then areas that are below the mean high tide water line, which is where the riparian rights begin, that would be where the entirety of the pier is going to be. So there may be ankle deep water or something like that that someone could wade into that would be landward, if you will, of the mean high tide water line, but still wet. Does that make sense?
But the pier is not going there.
Correct. It's going to be entirely within the navigable waters of the state.
Okay, so even if the conservation easement, even if we assume that the county can enforce this conservation easement that they can do any of that. Because the pier is not any part of it going to be within the space covered by the conservation easement, it doesn't violate the conservation easement.
That's correct, and the rule of submergence would say the same, Your Honor. So even if the conservation easement was effective in 2004, the fact that in 2023, our expert determined that the mean high tide water line was here, that extinguishes any rights, because it becomes the state waters, that extinguishes any rights to enforce the easement as to that water.
For those marginal few inches that the mean high water line has moved.
Correct.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about in this case is a finding by the circuit court judge that there are riparian water rights. They may exist along the fronting on the 39 feet. What we don't know yet, because we haven't gotten that far, is where exactly the pier is going to be. But if it's in the right place, it doesn't violate the conservation easement. In other words, if it's below the mean height water line, it does
Correct.
Not violate the easement.
Correct.
Okay.
I know my time is up.
You can answer Judge Albright's question.
No, that's correct. I think the only thing I was just going to say was that I think that, I know I've said it a couple times, the Gunby case is very instructive for the court about just how definite a document needs to be in order to sever or properly reserve riparian rights.
Right,
and
but I think in our colloquy you agree that if the conservation easement applies to this 39 feet, it severs your right to build a pier. The question is whether the conservation easement attaches to this 39 feet. My core question is still, why does any of this matter if you really are building it in the state waters? And I'm going to ask Mr. Leslie about that in a minute. But just maybe you connected these dots with Judge Albright and I missed it. But how is it that the conservation easement does not apply to these 39 feet?
By operation of the establishment of riparian rights to the mean high tide water line.
Well, okay, let me try it this way. You're not disputing that the conservation easement applies to the areas inland of the mean high water line within these 39 feet. There's 39 feet along the mean high water line, right?
Correct.
And inland of that, you're not disputing the conservation easement applies.
I may very well dispute that it applies as to the property, but not as to the buffer.
Well, all right. If it
only because the property may never have been properly conveyed to the county.
Okay, but the buffer, but it applies to the buffer regardless.
The buffer, I think, does continue to have application today.
Okay.
So, if I may ask,
of course.
So,
got to get this right.
Take me out to Worcester County again. So if the pier is going to be built entirely below the mean high water line, how does somebody get to it? Do you have to swim to it? I mean, how do you get to it?
So, I mean, that's a great question, Your Honor. From the landward side, I think someone would be free to walk to it. And I know the county may disagree with that, but I think they absolutely are able to traverse the buffer, if you will. If the buffer were meant to be entirely unused for any given purpose, the document would have said so. Or they would have conveyed the buffer to the county so that the county could have owned it in fee and regulated itself and not left it in private ownership. I also think if you read through the conservation easement, there's plenty of language in the easement that contemplates that human activity will be within the buffer. The other prohibited and restricted activities contemplate that there can be efforts to prevent erosion of your property and efforts to, I mean, even in Article 2D, it says that excavation, dredging, mining, and removal of loam, gravel, soil, rock, coal, petroleum, and other materials are prohibited except for the construction and or maintenance of means of access and wildlife habitat. So it doesn't prohibit all activity. I think it would be fine
right.
for someone to walk.
But then F says buildings, means of access, and other structures are prohibited on the property and buffer.
Sure, and I would actually say that means of access in subsection F is referring to means of access to buildings and or structures. And means of access, I also would say, would be building a road, and that's not what's being proposed. We were just talking about walking.
So and somebody's going to have to get their feet wet, basically, to get to the pier.
Sure. And I also think that it's entirely possible and within this owner's prerogative to build a pier, to have a boat moored, and to maybe not access it from the road at all. I think he would be, or excuse me, from his lot at all. They could. There's no prohibition against having a pier. And if he saw fit to construct a pier for purposes of taking a boat to the pier and fishing from the pier, I think he'd be permitted to do that.
Anything else from Mr. Mudd?
Thank you very much.
Okay, all right,
thank you.
Mr. Leslie, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I am not a boater, but I have never seen a pier that's not connected to land.
Okay, well, assume it's possible. If this pier, all right, is going to exist entirely below the mean high water line, why do you care?
Well, I'm not sure if you're...
Assume for the purposes of my question that it's factually true, that this thing, that as constructed, will be entirely within the state-owned navigable waters of Ayers Creek. What is the county or the land trust's interest or permitting authority or anything, if that's true?
If that's true, then we probably don't have an interest. They would just be going simply to MDE. Right now, they go to us and MDE
for a
shoreline construction permit.
So then, do you dispute the truth of that premise?
Yeah, I don't think it's believable that the pier is not going to be touching some kind of hard land.
It can be believable or not, but is the factual record of this case, does it indicate that the proposed pier would be built anywhere other than in the navigable waters of Ayers Creek that would be state property?
Sure. There's a crude diagram that goes right up to the edge of the land.
The edge is the edge, right? If it's all below outward from the mean high water board.
I will add a couple points. There has to be some kind of nexus to the property. If anybody could build a pier in the navigable waters, then we would have piers all over the place. There has to be some kind of nexus to the property.
When you say that, do you mean as a practical matter so people don't get their feet wet?
Or as a legal matter?
Why?
Where is the end?
Yeah. Why?
I'm not a pier person, so please explain it to me as if I was in fourth grade.
Sure. I guess I'm addressing it from a legal perspective in that there has to be some kind of connection to the land is what is giving you the rights to build the pier. If it's not connected...
If it's state property, why is that true?
Why does he have a right to build a pier in the middle of state
water? Wouldn't I have the right to build a pier?
I don't think you can.
Well, you keep saying that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you keep saying that, but what prohibits it?
You don't have, it's the state sovereign waters, and if you don't have riparian rights, if you don't have the connection to the land.
Okay, so they have riparian rights up to the mean high water mark. Where the conservation easement and other stuff kicks in is at the mean high water mark.
And I guess I would say, even if they're allowed to build the pier in state waters, the language of the conservation easement says prohibits means of access. And as you were saying, structures and things like that. So if somebody is traversing an unnatural activity, so somebody is traversing the easement to use the pier, that's a violation of the easement.
If they're walking, I mean, is it illegal to walk across the easement?
The language of the easement says means of access. So if you're using the buffer area to get to the pier, you're accessing the pier through the buffer, which is by its terms.
So nobody's allowed to walk through the buffer or the easement. I'm asking.
To get to a natural pier. It's using the means of access.
What does it matter if you're walking across the buffer to go crabbing or swimming versus getting a boat that's piered down the road?
It prohibits means of access. If you're using it, if you're getting to the pier... That is an unnatural object to use the water. The whole point of the pier is to use the water.
So the easement regulates the use of the navigable waters outside the scope of its boundary.
The access, yes.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
I want to follow up your earlier question on the state land, that the state wetlands wasn't delineated. I think my argument would be that the deed conveyed to the county all of the rights that the developer had, whatever they are, from the shoreline, from the exact shoreline forward, which in my opinion, that would encapsulate the riparian rights. That's what the point of the deed of easement. So we didn't necessarily have to have delineation. It's just whatever rights that the developer had, they are being conveyed.
When you say forward, you mean into the water or toward the land?
Into the deed cover from the heartland forward, the conservation easement covers from the edge of the shoreline backwards. Again, the two go hand in glove. That's why there's no gap. So if the water moves, then the line moves with them. There's never a gap between the rights delineated by the deed and the rights delineated by the conservation easement.
So your theory is on the riparian rights is that riparian rights live and die because they are connected to the land, and the people can't just go out into the waters and build wherever they want.
Yes.
But part of it is the access.
Yes, and the deed conveyed the rights from the edge forward to the county. If that fails, then we have the conservation easement that picks up. There's no space between the two, so the conservation easement picks up right after. And then again, if you look at the context, and I use that word, the word context, the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court has referred to using context to interpret a contract, like looking at the whole big picture. That's Credible Behavior Health versus Johnson, 466 MD380. So I think if you look at the context here, again, we're not just making something up. This is not something that we pulled out of a hat. This has been county policy for 20 years, and we're just trying to maintain the status.
Okay, but just so I understand what that policy is, you're saying that if there is a conservation easement over the buffer, that's effectively severs all of the riparian rights, period. The whole bundle, right? Just to use the first-year property law bundle of sticks analogy. Mr. Mudd walked us through all the different sticks, right? You're saying if there's a conservation easement over that buffer, that severs the whole bundle. They can't access the water. They can't use the water. They can't drink the water. They can't navigate through it if it involves crossing that buffer.
I don't know if I would go that far. I think
well,
it's the
you
pier.
Are going. You are going
well,
that
it's
far.
The building of the pier, because it's
why? Why? What's your authority for distinguishing among the sticks? When I asked you before about the pier being purely in the navigable water, you made it all about access. That accessing that pier was a violation of the conservation easement, even if all you're doing is walking. You could walk in the buffer for a million other reasons, but if you're walking across that buffer to access that pier, you're violating the easement.
Right.
But the effect of that argument is to say that if that conservation easement has the effect you're claiming, it severs their riparian rights in toto, doesn't it?
Potentially, I have not thought that through, but I
well,
was focusing
what's,
on the...
What's the principle? How is that not the case?
There may be other riparian rights that I'm not thinking of that could...
Every riparian right you can think of as the county's lawyer today is severed by the operation of that easement.
I think it's entirely possible. I don't know if it's...
Everyone actually, you can think of today. Everyone you've thought through for purposes of this case. I'm not trying to quiz you.
Again, looking at the context, that was the point of all these documents. Why are we here? Why did they put these together? They did it for a reason, to preserve this shoreline and to not allow things to be built in.
I have one more question, if I may.
Of course.
Would you think that the people who own Lot 14 now have the right to swim off the shore? Beyond the mean high water line?
I think so.
And do they have the right to swim if it's that deep? I don't know. Before, within the land side of the mean high water line?
Yeah, if they are not destroying vegetation. Have allowed things to regenerate.
Very carefully walking into the water this winter.
Yes, because it says it's supposed to revegetate naturally. I mean, I think just generally, the whole point is that it is undisturbed.
So there's some riparian rights that, I mean, swimming is part of a riparian right, I would think. So some riparian rights are preserved even after the conservation easement.
Sure, and again, I've been focusing on the language of the easement and fitting the dock into things that are in the easement, not riparian rights in general.
So you would acknowledge that not all riparian rights are extinguished by this easement?
I think what I was saying, I wasn't sure as I stood here.
I know, but now I'm more confused because what you said in your original answers to my question, which prompted me to follow up with you, was that it was not about what you were doing when you got to the water, but it was the access, that the conservation easement precluded access for certain purposes. Are you now saying that you could walk across the easement to go swimming, but you can't walk across the easement to access a pier that is otherwise in the navigable state-owned waters?
I think
same feet, same path, same disturbance, same everything.
Sure.
But it's what's in your heart about when you get to the other side.
There's a pier on the other side.
Right. Okay. But people sit on piers, people fish off piers, people swim off piers, people do a lot of things off piers. Sometimes they anchor boats to them. All right. I'm just trying to understand the county's position.
I will venture to.
Don't venture yet. Is if the issue that arrives, if the prohibition from the easement is a prohibition of access, when I asked you before, you were like, that cuts it off. It cuts off the riparian rights because it cuts off access. But then when you answer Judge Albright's excellent question about various riparian rights opportunities, you hedged. So now I'm trying to understand, what's the limiting principle? Does it matter what you plan to do on the other side of the buffer? Does it matter what's in your heart? Does it matter how much disturbing you can or can't do? What is the principle?
Sure. I think we get back to the language. They talk about unnatural activity, means of access. I tend to think accessing a dock is more on the unnatural side than swimming.
But that prohibits things inside the scope of the land that's covered by the easement, not accessing things that are outside the scope of the easement, right? If it is true that this pier will exist entirely outside the scope of the land covered by this easement, what you said before was accessing that pier through the easement was cut off, in essence cutting off their riparian rights. But then that's not what you said in response to Judge Albright. So now I'm trying to understand. I don't think you can point to the subsections of Article 2 of the easement and say the prohibition against building something in the easement prohibits somebody from walking appropriately across the buffer to get to something legally built somewhere else. Can you? So it matters what's in your heart, what you plan to do when you get to the other side?
They are disturbing the vegetation to
an extent. No, but that's different. I'm just picking up on if there's sensitive vegetation or wildlife habitat or something in there that you can't disturb under the terms of the easement, that's fine. I'm not talking about walking across the snail darters to get to the pier. I'm talking about, like, you're allowed to go across this buffer on foot. You're saying it matters what the purpose of your walk is. If you're walking to go swimming, that's okay. If you're walking to go to a structure that's built legally outside the scope of the easement, that's not okay. Is that the county's position?
I think the intent of this was to not have things built either in the buffer or off of the water.
Okay, but your position is the easement can limit what's built outside the scope of the land covered by the easement.
I think in some circumstances it could.
And what's your authority for that proposition?
That, back to the language on unnatural activities and means of access. If you're accessing the unnatural dock, I think you're violating the spirit and the language of the conservation easement.
Okay. Because you're getting that from the easement itself, not from some broader scope of authority.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from Mr. Wilson? Okay, thanks to you both. It's an interesting case.
Yes,
case is submitted.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you both for tolerating our questions and our follow-up questions. All right, next case is number 1590.